All right. So the question was, will the final be in the same format as a class test? And the answer is mostly. You will have a few new types of questions because we have a little more time, but for the most part, you can expect there will be the standard vocabulary questions. You're going to have the standard fill-in-the-blank short answer questions, and there's going to be a good amount of reading and writing code questions on the final. So, easy way to get points. Make sure you review all of the vocabulary from exam 1, 2, and 3, and all the glossary terms in your textbook. Next question. All right. So the study sheet I put up has a couple of different sections. The first section is general computer science. And this is kind of theory of computer science, and some of the stuff will look familiar because we've covered it in Python explicitly. A lot of it is stuff that will apply to any language. So these are mostly questions to get you thinking about what you know and what you might want to read about and study a little more. The page after that is kind of Python-specific stuff, and that has to do with a lot of the things in the general question section, but made specific for Python. You know, so how do you do iteration or conditional specifically in Python? That's more the syntax level stuff of Python. There's some things in there that are specific to Python, you know, like a list, how do you take a slice out of a list? That works a little bit differently in Python than in other languages. We also have, at the very bottom, a little section about the robot and Miro. So basically, the things you should know about the robot and Miro. Now, there's a few things that are explicitly not on this study guide, so I don't have any practice problems per se, although if you look on the class website in the resources column, there's practice test problems like 1 and 2 that have already been up there with answers. Also, all of the exams 1, 2, and 3 are good sources of practice problems. And if you want, you can go back and look at previous courses' exams as well. I don't have a list of all of the different Python functions you should know about, or all of the different Miro API function calls you should know about, but assume that basically anything you've used in class you should be able to recognize, and the stuff you've used a lot, like forward, reverse, turn left, turn right, stop, take picture, those types of things, maybe get obstacle, you're probably going to need to know, so you should just review really quickly those things. So, you've had a little time to review it. Are there any questions on this that you'd like me to talk about? Would you like me to start at the beginning and read through it, or... I'm sure there's some things on this list that are going to be more difficult than others. I'd like to spend my time on the parts that you look up and you're like, huh, what is that? As opposed to the parts you look at and you say, yeah, I know that. Questions? All right. Well, then I'll go into some of my favorites. So, computational complexity. It's a very theoretical topic. So I have some questions up here. You know, what is it? Why is it useful? What do we do with it? That type of thing. What's it good for? So big O notation is basically the algorithmic complexity or the computational complexity of an algorithm. We do this, or we use it, to evaluate different algorithms in relation to one another, specifically how they will behave as the amount of work you want them to do goes up. So, for example, if you have a list of numbers and you want to sort it, or just search through it. So, if you have a list of 10 numbers and you want to say, hey, is, you know, the number 5 in there? And if so, where is it? You could do a linear search. You just look at each item. You say, hey, is this 5? And if it is, I say, yeah, I found it. Here it is. That's an order O, or sorry, an order N operation on average. because you have to look at all elements. So there's 10 elements, you have to do 10 looks to make sure it's in there or not in there. Now, if the list was sorted, you could do it faster. You could do log n. So when the list is sorted, you have this property that every element is smaller than the element to its left, or sorry, right, depending on which way you're sorting it. And you can take advantage of that property by looking in the middle and saying, hey, 5 is bigger than 2, throw it out on this bit, look in the next middle, say, hey, it's not there. And it takes log n instead of n operations. So by doing that, you can say, hey, searching in a sorted list is faster than searching in an unsorted list. And it's always going to be faster, because if I draw a graph here of the number of items against the work, that's linear, n right there. So as I go up to 1,000,000 items, it's going to take me 1,000,000 looks into the list, so 1,000,000 units of work. But if it's sorted, it's going to be n log or log n. And so it can take me 20 or 30 looks into the list to verify whether or not a number's in the list, and if it is, find it. So as your numbers increase, your work increases, but it increases very slowly, because log n increases slowly as n increases. Now, if I have a list of numbers that are unsorted, and I want to sort them, I could do something like a double sort. And that's going to be big O of n squared. So you should realize why that's n squared, because the bubble sort goes through every item in the list, and then it does it again, and again, and again. And the number of times it does it is also the number of items in the list. Technically, it's n minus 1 and n minus 1, so it's not quite n squared, but it's so close that we just throw out our constants, we just say it's n squared. And as n increases, n squared increases much faster. So if n is 10, n squared is 100. If n is 1,000, n squared is like 1,000,000. If n is 1,000,000, n squared gets really big really fast. Whereas n gets big, but not as fast. So when n is 1,000,000, the work is 1,000,000 units. When n is 1,000,000 and you're using an n squared like quicksort, it's 1,000,000 times 1,000,000, which is a lot more. Now, luckily, there's a sorting algorithm like merge sort or quicksort that's n log n. So it's basically halfway between n and n squared. It's basically combining the log n and the n here. And what that tells us is we can make an estimate for how long it will take to sort a list using quicksort. And if we double the size of the list, how much more work do we have to do? So if you have a list with 1,000,000 elements, you say, well, n is 1,000,000 times log n, which is, say, 20-some, you know, so you have 20 million work units. And then you say, okay, well, if I have 5 million, so you can say, well, 5 million times log of 5 million, which is going to be like 23 or 24, you know, so now I have 24 million. You can say, hey, it's getting bigger, but it's not getting bigger too fast. And you can kind of look at the ratio and see how much time it's going to take. And you can say, well, the quicksort or the merge sort is always going to be faster than a bubble sort when n grows. And so it's really useful to be able to examine different algorithms to say, you know, how is this thing going to grow as my number increases? You know, so somebody hires you for realtor.com to make a nice fancy GUI where you have neat little sliders, JavaScript sliders that, you know, say, all right, you know, which houses meet your query? And they give you a test set of 10 houses. And you go and work on it, and you make a really nice thing where people can set their upper and lower price points and how many bedrooms they want, and it reduces the number of houses in view until it's down to, you know, however many they want to look at. That works great, and you can use any algorithm you want because you're only dealing with 10 houses. But when they look at it and they say, this is great, let's go live with it, put it on our main website where we have, you know, millions of people a day looking at it, and we have 1,000,000 or 2,000,000 houses in our database, you have to make sure the algorithms you're using have enough speed to work with something where the size increases like that. So it's very important to be able to judge, hey, between these two algorithms, which one's faster as the number of items increases. So let's talk about some basic stuff. What's a program? Who can define what a program is? Go ahead. What's a program?
Side instructions that tell the computer what to do.
That's good enough to pass the question. A program is a set of instructions that tell the computer what to do. You could also call it a recipe that the computer executes. You know, it's what you tell the computer to do and the computer executes it. So an algorithm is similar to a program. It's kind of the difference between math and computer science. Now, see this graph here? Hope you guys are all comfortable with it, because I might ask you to recreate it. I might just say on the test, hey, write a graph of the four different complexity classes we've learned, label each line, and give an example algorithm. That should be something you can do. You know, all you have to do is remember the complexity classes, n squared, n log n, and log n, and then kind of get a graph, you know, kind of graph it right. You notice I don't have any grid lines here, just as long as the lines are in the right order and kind of the right shape, that's about all you need to do. But you should have an idea of what that graph looks like and what it represents. So an algorithm is a set of steps that you follow to get something done, solve a problem or whatever. Technically, it usually has a termination point, or it usually finishes and gives a result. Not always, but it's nice if it does. A program is actually how you implement an algorithm into some instructions that a computer can execute. So math has kind of these logical constructs where they say, this is true, you know, this is equal to that. There's portions of math where they actually develop algorithms for solving things numerically. Computer science, everything we do can be executed on a computer. So it may or may not be technically perfect. It might not have that math assurance of a proof. But we can give you something that says, hey, execute this on a computer and it's going to give you, you know, some result that you want, hopefully. Otherwise, you wouldn't execute it. I was playing a little video at the beginning of class about some people who cheated or stole $20 million from online poker sites, or players of online poker sites, by getting administrative accounts and looking at the cards that everybody else had. So, why is it important to understand how computer programs are made? You might want to know how different things are calculated. For example, your grades. They're stored in T-square. I also have a copy of Excel on my laptop. Your grade is calculated by T-square, and unless I spot a problem, I just take that grade and I export it to Banner, which goes into your transcript system, and you get the grade and report card. So having taken this class, and I'm assuming you've all probably made at least one error in your program, does that make you feel better or worse about how your grades are stored? So you should understand that anything having to do with the computer can conceptually have a problem or a bug, give you the wrong result. So you shouldn't trust the output of a computer blindly. If somebody gives you a spreadsheet that says, hey, you know, here's how you calculate the selling price of this house, and you put in some things, and you know, all right, $50,000 is what I should ask for, you know, but it's a four-bedroom house in Buckhead. You have to take things with a grain of salt, and you have to evaluate the program and the source of the program. So if you're driving around and you stamp on your brake pedal real hard because, you know, something swiveled in front of you or a gear jumped out, your brakes are most likely, unless you have an old funker, anti-lock brake systems. And they have a little microchip in there, a little computer, that figures out the speed that your wheels are turning and how much brake pressure they can apply to keep you slowing down without skidding your wheels. Because if you lock up the wheels entirely, little balls of rubber form underneath the wheels between the wheels of the road, and it actually will take longer to stop than if you keep the wheels spinning but with friction on it. So the whole point of anti-lock brake systems is to keep you from skidding. Those kind of have to work. And the people who build them, the automotive engineers and the computer and electrical engineers, have written very careful small pieces of program
that they are very certain will work, and they've done a lot of testing on them. And in some cases, they've proved that they work by using mathematical proof systems to verify that, yes, this upholds certain properties. There's things like pacemakers, flight control systems are in commercial and military aircrafts, a lot of car electronics for the engine ignition system, that type of thing, where a high degree of care has been taken to make sure it works right. And in a lot of cases, there are engineers working on it who have certain professional obligations and legal obligations to make sure things work right. But there's a lot of other programs out there, like T-Square. T-Square is actually an open source product. It's maintained by a whole bunch of different schools. So our school has OIT, and they have a couple of people who work on T-Square, and they write program patches and fixes, and they add enhancements to it. And the code they write, they upload to a Subversion repository, and they merge it in with everybody else's code from all these other schools that maintain it. And then the schools download the code, and they install it and use it. So that's either very cool or very scary, depending on your standpoint. We have a lot of different people working on the code. No single person has the key responsibility for making sure it's right. You get a lot of features, you get a lot of cool stuff, and it's very cheap for the university because they share development costs with all the other universities. But we have humans working at a university writing this code, and there's not really a giant overarching company or institution that's in charge of making sure it's correct. So, you know, your T-squared grading is somewhere between automotive, you know, auto-lock brake systems and pacemakers, and, you know, the Excel sheet that some teacher makes to keep your grades. You know, in complexity, it's much more complex than either of those, but in, you know, quality control as well. Now, I trust it. I've looked at it, and you know, it's pretty easy to check. You just look at all your grades, you calculate it yourself, you compare it to what T-Square says, and you say yes or no. But this is something you should realize when you're dealing with computer programs anywhere. Not to get you, you know, all depressed and stuff, but computer programs can have errors. You've created a lot of syntax errors, you know, the simple errors. Compiler catches that. It says, hey, this program you've written, you claim it's in Python, but it's not valid Python. You're missing a colon here. And so all you have to do is you go in and put the colon in and you fix your syntax error. It's an error in the syntax, you know, the layout of the program. And there's other errors, there's semantic errors, which are harder. So you might have something where there's an if statement, and you say, you know, if user's grade bigger than 90, then letter grade is assigned A. So what happens if somebody has 90.00? They're going to get a B because you did bigger than as opposed to bigger than or equal or bigger than and equal. And that's a semantic error because the computer says, oh, yep, perfectly syntax valid. I'm going to run it. I'm going to execute it. And you're probably going to get the answer you want except in that one case where somebody has exactly a 90.0 class. And so you have a semantic error. And those are the ones that are harder to catch because the computer can't help you catch it. Computer says, I'm doing exactly what you told me, bud. You know, and it's up to you to catch that, oh wait, what I told you was wrong, and then fix it. So there's a semantic error. There's also runtime errors. Like you run out of memory, an exception gets raised. You exceed the maximum stack depth. You know, you have a recursive thing that goes out of control. The system will run, it will raise these runtime errors. The programmer can catch them with the try and accept and handle them, but it's up to you to try to catch them if you want to. So those are kind of three types of errors, you know, that you can misbehave and how your program's going to have problems with them. So computers themselves have really only been around since the end of World War II. There were a few electromechanical systems built before World War II. Charles Babbage attempted to build calculation engine and differential engine. Analytical engine, but the real computers as we think of them today have only been around for about 60, 70 years. And early on, they were used mostly militarily, calculating artillery paths, tables for artillery paths, as well as breaking codes. Bletchley Park, the computers there were mostly for breaking Enigma and other German codes. So I've already mentioned vocabulary is going to be on the final. You should know it all. You should understand what recursion is. So who has a definition of recursion? Short answer, definition of recursion.
Function that calls itself.
You can also do kind of mutual recursion, where a function called A calls the function B, and function B calls A, and function A calls B, and so it calls back and forth. But the simple term is you have a function, it calls itself. You need a few things to be successful with recursion. You need a terminating condition. So, for example, if you say, all right, I want to get a number from the user, and the function says to the user, give me a number, and the user types THREE, and the function tries to convert it to an integer, and you get an exception. Then the function says, hey, that's not a valid number, I'm going to call myself again. And the terminating condition is when the user types in a valid number, like the number 3, and it converts it to an integer, it says, hey, I got a valid number, I'm going to return it. And then you have a termination of your recursion because the function no longer calls itself. It returns back up and we get the number out. So what's iteration? How would you do an iterative? What's iteration in Python look like? For loop, while statement. Those are two different ways to iterate. You could technically iterate with recursion, because iteration is doing the same thing multiple times. So if your function calls itself, it's basically doing the same thing multiple times. You can iterate over like the numbers in a list. So a for loop would iterate over that real easy. And basically you're doing code the same thing multiple times. So you might add one to every item in the list. So add one to this list item is the code you're doing, and the iteration is doing it to every item. You might also do things more complicated where you're saying, I have a temp variable. It's going to start at 0. I'm going to take every item in my list and add it to the temp variable. I'm going to count how many items are in the list. I'm going to divide by that number and get the average. So you iterate over every item in this list. You can also iterate for an unlimited number of times with a while loop, or an uncounted times with a while loop, with a Boolean expression. Let me give you some code example here to talk about execution of code. So you have some lines of code, and you have a while statement. And inside of it, you have a Boolean expression. And then you have a block of code inside of it. And then you have some more code that's in line with this first code up here. So what's the flow of execution? What does that term mean? When I talk about the flow of execution, it's something you all have to understand when you go write programs. It helps if you have a name for it. What does it sound like I'm talking about? I'm going to take a guess. The way the computer goes through your program. The order of execution, or the flow of execution, starts at the top, goes down. If it hits something like a while loop, it evaluates the Boolean expression, and if it's true, it'll do this stuff. And then, with a while loop, it actually loops back up here, and if it's true still, it'll do it again. So this is iterating. It's repeating the same loop of code. And when your thing gets false, it'll go back down here and do this bit. So it comes down, goes there, and does that bit. Now, the difference between a while loop and an if statement is just that the if statement doesn't repeat. So that's conditional execution. So I come down, I say, if this is true, I do this. So if it's true, I go in there and do that. When I get done, I come back out here and do the rest of this. But if it's false, I don't. I just jump right down there, I jump around it. Now, you can do more complicated if statements. There's if else, where you specifically say, if this is true, do this, if this is false, do that, and then keep going. There's if, elif, 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 else, where you can say, if this is true, do this, if that's true, do that, if this is true, do that, otherwise, do this. But really, they're all just more complicated versions of a standard if statement, which is basically, if something's true, do the code, if it's not, jump over it and keep going. While loop is like an if statement, except it checks it multiple times. So the flow of execution is modified by iteration, conditional execution. Another thing that modifies is function calls. So if I have over in the math library an absolute value function, you know, I have some code that's going to return
files of X. I can be running through my code, and if I have a line of code here that says something like, Z is assigned absolute value of -7, which is kind of stupid. I probably wouldn't put -7 in there. I probably have a variable. So I might have something like B. So B's pointing at something. Let's talk about assignment. B is assigned -7. Assignment basically takes the identifier B and makes it point at a number, in this case -7. So now B is pointing at that. So here we're going through flow of execution. When we hit the function call, we call a function, we pass in a parameter. So you should know how to define a function here. I've defined this function, say def. I have a parameter, which is called x over there. You should know how to define functions with parameters. I look up b, I evaluate b, it says, hey, b's pointing at -7. So this is -7. So I assign -7 to x. Then I run some code, I get +7. And I return +7. So you can see that the flow of execution went from here all the way up to the screen over there, executed that, and then the return statement popped it back. So function calls modify the flow of execution. They kind of do it in line. You can think of taking all that stuff in the function and putting it right there. You also pass parameters into the function, and you get this return value back. So when you evaluate this function, the Python interpreter evaluates it and basically replaces it with whatever value it returns, which in this case is a 7. And then we do an assignment, so z is now pointing at 7. And we keep going with the code. So I just talked about defining functions, passing parameters, returning values, how calling a function kind of affects the flow of execution. I have three different types of programming, different paradigms of programming. They merge together, so it's a little wishy-washy. That's why I have everything in quotes there. We have functional programming, object-oriented programming, and then something else which is known by a couple different terms, either imperative or procedural programming. So in this class, what have we been primarily learning of those three? So here's how you solve that question on the test. You think, well, I remember he talked about object-oriented programming for 2 days. I remember he talked about functional programming for 1 day. So the other thing must have been what he was talking about all the other days. So Python, what we've been doing so far is basically imperative or procedural programming. We give step-by-step directions. We're giving this imperative. Do this, do that, do this other thing to the computer. Functional programming is similar to imperative programming. The line kind of blurs. When you start using map and filter, reduce, you're really doing functional programming at that point. The idea of functional programming is that everything is a function, or functions are first-class objects, and you can pass functions as a parameter to functions. So instead of passing just a value, if I call something like map, I pass it a list, and I pass it a function that I want to apply to everything on the list. You should understand how map, filter, and reduce work. You should also know how to build unnamed temporary functions with the lambda. So basically you say lambda, and then there's some syntax, and you build a temporary unnamed function, and you can pass it in really easy that way. Object-oriented programming, you have an object that encapsulates both the data and the behavior. So with procedural programming, we just kind of declare variables. You know, your function or your program has some variables declared, either in a function or kind of out in the global file scope. With object-oriented programming, we say we're going to make an object. You know, it's an animal object. And the animal has some data and it has some behavior, and it's all encapsulated in this object. That's the big difference there. Under the hood, the very low-level programming stuff is all done with these imperative statements. So in object-oriented programming, all the behavior is done with kind of procedural programming statements. So the same thing is kind of true in functional programming as well. You should understand Boolean expressions. They're really simple. You've done a lot of them with math. The only tricky bits are that a computer's doing them instead of a human. So is that true or false? or you have no idea. But if you know that A is pointing at 3, now you can figure it out.
True or false?
So this is true. So when you evaluate this, you get a T or a true. Now you might say something like 5 is bigger than A, or 3 is less than or equal to A. So is 3 less than or equal to A? Is that true or false?
True.
Alright. So here I basically have true or true. So let's do a truth table. So here are my possible inputs to OR. So if I have true or true, I get a true out. What if I do true or false? True or false is true. How about false or false?
False, false.
All right, so there's a truth table. With that truth table, or just remembering how OR works, you can generate a correct answer here. So if I change that, this is a false. What's the correct answer?
True.
It's going to be true. Now, there's a different truth table for AND. So you should be able to write the truth table for AND. You change this to AND. Get rid of these guys. Put in the AND value. So what's this going to be?
True.
How about this guy?
False.
How about all the other guys? So two trues make a true with an AND. True and any type of false, or false and anything is false. So there's a difference there. How about not? Not is a little different because it only takes one value in. So not T is going to be false. Not false is going to be true. Not's pretty simple. That makes sense. You have to understand all of those things so that if you see a piece of code that says something like, if the user's birthday or if the user's age is bigger than 18, or the user's parent age is less than 45, then do something. So you have to understand, you know, what are they saying there? And in that case, either of them can be true, because it's an OR. So if you're 5 years old, but your parent is 62, well, I forget which way I put the thing, bigger or less than. But if you have the code, you have to be able to figure out, is this thing going to evaluate to true or false? It's also the not's kind of useful for while loops. You can do something like while the length of this thing is not zero. So you might have something like this. The length of list is equal to zero. And then you say, wait, I don't want to do that. I want to do not that. So I can just put a not here. Or there's a special thing called not equal, which is easy to use. Like that. You can do that too. But you should understand what the not would do to that system. You have to understand how to open files. And you have to understand a little bit about file systems. You know, a file system is what stores the files. They're not all just in one place. They have directories, and there's, you know, this hierarchical kind of tree-like structure where you have, you know, your root drive and your CS1301, and you have your homeworks and your labs, and inside of those you have the files. Or maybe you have them all thrown on your desktop. It's up to you how you do it. Why do you put things onto a file system? Why do you put them on a disk or a USB drive as opposed to just keeping it in memory all the time? I mean, memory's faster. Why does anybody ever use a hard drive? So it keeps it to a power outage. What's another reason for using a hard drive? Costs. You can do, you know, 300 gigabytes for a couple hundred bucks. 300 gigabytes of RAM is getting cheaper, but it's not that cheap. So hard drives are slower, but they last through power outages. They're non-volatile, so they will last through power outages. They also, for density, they cost less money. Nowadays, flash drives, like USB flash drives, are getting lower in price, but they're not quite as cheap as hard drives. They're still non-volatile memory. They're cheaper than RAM, but they're also much slower than RAM. So RAM, or random access memory, is very fast. It's kind of local working cache, what the computer's using right now.
What's Python? What's the short answer to what is Python? Python is a programming language. Where did it get its name?
Monty Python.
Monty Python and Flying Circus. And it's a dynamic language. What does that mean? There's a couple. What was that? Constantly being updated. So basically, if you type something in idle and press enter, it gives you an answer back immediately. There's some technical definitions for it, having to do with the fact that everything you enter is executed or evaluated immediately. It doesn't take the code and compile it into an executable and then run it later. It basically, when you type code, it just executes it immediately. It's live, that type of thing. We've learned some data types in Python. How is stuff stored in a computer? What are four different basic data types in Python?
String.
You got a string, tuple, list, int. All right, so two of those are basic data types. Integer is the most basic data type. A string is kind of halfway between basic and compound. Technically, it's compound, but we call it a basic. So what are some other basic data types?
Boolean.
Integer, Boolean, float. All right, so that's probably enough. You can put in string there if you want. Compound data types, you've already listed tuple, list, what else?
Dictionary.
So, what's the difference between a tuple and a list? So, tuple is immutable, which means you can't change it once you create it. Tuples really aren't too useful unless you need an immutable data type. So, for example, for a dictionary, the key to a dictionary has to be immutable. So a string or a tuple can be used, but a list can't be used. So if you want to use a list of data, like both somebody's name and their age as the index into a database, you can't put them in a list. You have to put them in a tuple. Other than that, you're probably going to use a list most of the time, just to store bunches of data. You need to know how to do bracket operations. So if you have a list with five things in it, you need to have to know how to grab one thing out of it or set one thing. So you have like bracket with the index. You're definitely needing to know how to do slices. So taking a portion of a list and making a copy of it, that's the colon operator inside the brackets. You have to know how to, you should know the difference between an alias and a copy. So if you take a list and you have something like a variable is pointing at a list, and then you say B is assigned A, B is an alias to A that's pointing at the same list. But if you say B is assigned A bracket colon bracket, or I should say C is assigned that, you're going to make a copy. And now C is pointing to a copy of that list. So when I did bracket blank colon blank bracket, I'm basically using default things there. So if you put a blank in before the colon, it assumes the beginning of the list. If you put a blank at the end of the colon, it assumes the end of the list. So you can leave one or the both blank to assume those things. If you're having trouble visualizing that in your head without me typing on the idle interpreter, it means you should go to the idle interpreter and practice with all of this. So you really need to know how to take a slice, a section out of a list. The slices also work for strings. You should know what an identifier is. An identifier is a name that points to stuff. You should know what a valid identifier is. So you can't say 34 Q. You have to say Q34. You can have numbers in it, but they can't start with a number. You should really understand how assignment works. So assignment's a little funky in that what's on the right-hand side gets evaluated first. You're used to reading left to right, but here, what's on the right-hand side gets evaluated first. And what happens here is it says, hey, what is my name pointing at? So somewhere in memory, there's a variable or an identifier, and it's pointing at like 5. So it says, hey, what's that pointing at? So it evaluates the identifier, it says, hey, it's pointing at 5, so we get 5 plus 1. So we add those together, we get 6. And now, the assignment makes my name point at 6. So it changes this guy, so now it's pointing to the 6. And so you can see a couple things are happening there. We evaluate the identifier, we get the value it's pointing at, we add that value to 1, we have a new value, and then we assign my name to point at the new value. You really need to understand what's going on there. It seems relatively simple, but you have to understand all three of those steps as they happen and the order they happen, as opposed to just remembering kind of what increments my name by one. Because how it increments my name by one is kind of special. And that can get you into trouble if you don't understand how that's happening. It won't work if it's reversed, for example. The assignment operator always makes the identifier on the left point to whatever the value is on the right. I've talked about if and else and map filter reduce, the bracket operators, slices. You have to know how to open a file, read from a file, write to a file. Now, I have not listed all of the different function calls you need to know about, especially not the ones in Miro. I'm not going to, you know, make this a super memory test. This isn't a biology exam where you have to remember all 106 bones in the body. But it's assumed that you do know the basic ones, the ones you've used a lot, like take picture, forward, back, left, right, turn left, turn right, get obstacle. What's the difference between get obstacle and get IR? You should understand that, you know, there's different infrared sensors. The get IR sensors are on the Scribbler robot. The get obstacle sensors are on the Fluke. You should kind of understand the difference there and the difference between the API call and get them. You should know what Miro is. So what is Miro? If I say, what is Miro? What's a little three-word explanation of what Miro is? Miro is a Python module. So it's a module just like any other Python module. It controls your robot. It has specialized functions that connect to and give it commands and use the beeper and the lights and the motors and the sensors. But it also offers things that don't have anything to do with your robot. So our representation of pictures, that particular definition of, okay, there's an XY grid, and each pixel has, you know, 3 bytes, a red, a green, and a blue component. It also has an alpha component, but we haven't used that. That's built into Miro. There's also things like the graphics objects. So if you want to make the face with your mugshot, or not the mugshot, but you know, when you made your face, those graphic objects are in Miro. There's functions like time remaining that help you write code that's a little easier to read. And there's functions like ask, which will pop up a dialog and ask the user something. You click on the button and it returns the button you clicked. And you should understand how pictures are represented in Miro. The icons, the things like get pixels, get a pixel at a particular XY location. You should understand kind of those things. Questions about the exam other than that? Okay. Well, I will see you on Wednesday. Thank you very much.